This is the fourth talk in the series today that we're doing on how to identify and handle wicked people. There's just a couple of questions that have been passed to me in the break. And one says, you referred to Genesis 6:5, apparently quoting from the KJV, actually it was the RSV, which uses the word continually. But the NIV translates it as all the time. Is the NIV wrong at this point? Well, I wouldn't say the NIV is wrong as such. The NIV is a looser translation than translations like NASB and RSV and ESV, which are tighter and more direct. NIV is halfway between being a literal translation and a kind of dynamic equivalency translation. It's halfway between those two things. So when it says the words all the time in NIV, I don't think it's necessarily improper or wrong. We often use the phrase all the time. He'll say, you see that fella, he's in the park all the time walking that dog. And it's a sort of phrase. The NIV will use more language of that kind, which is looser and more expressive perhaps, whereas other translations like NASB in particular will use exact words. So the right word, I think, is continually, meaning intermittent but continuing and ongoing, consistent and regular, as opposed to continuously, which means absolutely all the time. But when someone uses the phrase all the time, they don't necessarily literally mean all the time. It depends on the context, like when, you know, he walks his dog all the time. We look at the context and we say, I know what they mean. They mean he's continually walking his dog. Second question is, can you tell a lie if it's to save someone's life? Now, rather than address all this, I did deal with this issue last year on a teaching MP3 about the subject of truthfulness. So if you look at that, but the short answer is, yes, it is okay to tell a lie to save someone's life. And the one example that we actually are given in the Bible is that of Rahab the harlot, who told a lie to save the life of the spies who had gone into the land. And so not only was it okay for her to do it, but the actual position is that later we're told in the letter to the Hebrews that it was considered to be a real act of righteousness on her part to have done that. And so she finds her way into the Hall of Fame in Hebrews chapter 11, and she finds her way in there in large part for telling a lie to save the life of those men. So, as I said in the tape on truthfulness, if you're in a situation where you need to save the life of someone, then you can tell a lie. Or if you're entitled to kill somebody, if you're entitled to kill them because you're fighting World War II, you can tell lies to make people think that the invasion is going to come at Calais. That's okay. Because if you're entitled to kill someone, you're entitled to lie to them. And if you're trying to save a person's life, then you could. But otherwise, pretty much, we can't tell a lie. And that's a shortened version of, you see, you don't need the MP3 now, you've got that. And that's what I've said on the truthfulness tape. Right, back to the story. Let me tell you now about another wicked PA of mine. It seems to be a consistent theme, this. But this one's called Julie. She began as a secretary. She was someone else's secretary. And it was when, I think, Tracy went, because Tracy had to go over her wrongdoings. And so in stepped Julie. But because my IQ was low in those days, I didn't properly check and thoroughly vet people. I needed someone to write a book 6 for me and give it to me. I needed, Biff Tannen to go into the future, bring the book and bring it back to me. That would have been very handy if Biff had done that. But the point was, she began as my PA, eventually really worked her way up to being effectively an office manager. Now this woman, Julie, was an expert in the art of deception. She was a real, real professional. She wasn't a Christian, but she did actually at one point pretend to have become one. She started coming along to a Bible study that I did, and she said that she'd become a Christian. Well, I didn't think she had. I didn't think it was real, but I just thought she was confused and not understanding things properly. But I didn't think she was putting it on as an act. But that was the view I later formed, that whole thing was just an act to impress me. Anyway, this is the story. She told a lot of lies for a long time. She was eventually caught out because what she did in the end there was a person who I'll give the name Terry. Terry worked for me as well. And Terry had been given the job, together with another chap, his name was Brian, I think, to carry my boardroom table from one place to another. So they carried it from one room to another room and reassembled it. Now, the thing was, Julie tried to cause Terry to lose his job, because he was beginning to see through her. He was beginning to cotton on to what she was, that she was a liar. He saw it before I did. He was beginning to rumble her, and she needed to get rid of him. This is the point. The wicked will defend themselves, and they will use lies as weapons. That's the point. We don't tend to think in those terms, but lies are weapons. Trying to get the Germans to think the invasion would be at Calais caused Hitler to keep at least two panzer divisions pinned down in Calais even after the invasion had happened. He thought the Normandy invasion was just a trick because he was so convinced by the lie. The point is, little folk use lies as weapons just the same. And she used this trick to try and get him to lose his job. And what she did was, she scratched this boardroom table. She got a sharp implement and scratched the boardroom table to try to get me to think that Terry had damaged it in transit on the way over. And she thought that I would get cross with Terry. Little did she know me, I wouldn't have got cross with Terry. I never used to get cross with people for making mistakes. This is what I was saying earlier about be merciful to people's mistakes, but not merciful to their malice. For example, changing the subject, there was once a time when one of the cashiers, we had a large cashier's department, and one of them made a blunder one day and lost me £3,000 by a mistake. And she came over in trepidation. She thought she was going to be guillotined. She came over, she thought I was going to put a blindfold on her and offer her a last cigarette. And that's what she was expecting. That's what she was expecting. And I just said, oh, well, there we are then. Don't do it again. And that's all I would say. If you do make a mistake and lose me £3,000, I'll just say, oh, well, don't try not to do it again. And if you'd scratch the boardroom table, that's what I would say. See, Julie didn't understand me. You show mercy to people's mistakes, but you don't show mercy to people's malice. If you see malice, do not tolerate it. Do not. Deal with it. Anyway, back to the story. She scratched this table, but she miscalculated. And so what had happened was, I came back to my office at an unexpected time, and I saw the table undamaged. And there it was, fine, no problem with it. But later I went out again, only popped in for a minute, looked at the table, thought, oh, that's nice, came back again, out again, came back again. When I came back, there was a little neat pile of dust, varnish dust, and it was right on the route that I would go past the boardroom table to get to my desk. I saw this little neat pile of varnish dust, and I looked at it, and I remember thinking at the time how beautiful it looked. Just a perfect little pile of varnish dust. It has formed a beautiful pattern. And what had happened was, someone had taken like a knife or screwdriver and just gone across the boardroom table and made this little pile of dust. Now, Julie hoped that I would think that Terry had done it. And she said that Terry had done it in transit. But she miscalculated. Because I was an ex-Bobby and a 20-odd years experience as a commercial litigator, and I'm well used to forensics and evidence and gathering evidence. So my IQ may be low in some ways, but in other ways, it's fairly high. And when I saw this, I knew that that had not been done by Terry in transit, because unbeknownst to her, I had been in earlier. Only for 2 minutes, but she didn't know that. And when I was, after I'd gone, when the table was in my room, she scratched it to make me think Terry had damaged it. And that's the background. But I saw, and God even drew my eyes to this. Sometimes he just sort of laser guides your eyes to see something. Have you ever felt that? When he laser guides you to see a thing. And I was drawn to this neat pile of dust. And God wanted me to see it on the way into the room on the first time. On the second time, but not there the first time. And so, my eyes began to open to her. Why is she saying that Terry's done this when he plainly hasn't? How did it get there? It was in my room by then. How did a neat pile of varnish dust get onto my desk? Why is she, the only person who was in my room, saying that Terry did it? And so I began to check. And once you see a thing like that, when you see something, you must then begin to carry out checks. If you see something to cause you suspicion or a concern, don't leave it at that. Begin to check. So I began to check other things. I began to look into more things, ask a lot more questions. And more came out. And more emerged about Julie that I hadn't realized. But I hadn't realized it because I wasn't looking. If you're not looking, you won't find. If you're not expecting to find, you won't find. If you're not asking questions, no answers will come. But anyway, I concluded that she had damaged it deliberately. But then, as I began to look into more things came out. And just here are just a few of them that came out of the things she'd done over a few years. And one of them was that she'd been running a small business from my office for herself. She was making greetings cards in the evenings and so forth, and weekends. And she was making them at the office while being paid overtime. And the point was, she had actually asked me for permission to store her card-making material at the office. And she had said she hadn't got enough room for all the material at home. Would it be okay to store the materials at the office? Not to work at the office, not to do the work, just to store the stuff. Because we had a huge office, and I thought, well, that's no problem. No, yeah, it's fine. Just put it in the office. No problem. So there it was, stored at the office. But you see the cleverness of that. Because it was stored there, it was ready and available to be used. And also, it didn't look suspicious because I'd authorized it to be stored there. So, no problem. But the point was, what she was actually doing was working on making cards in the evenings on overtime. So she used to stay virtually every evening doing overtime on full pay. And so I was paying her overtime to make greetings cards, which she could then sell. This went on for a long time. But the way she used to get round it, because you might say, well, why didn't people report her? And what she used to do, at 5:30, she would go around and tell people to leave. We had a big office, and there were, you know, people all over the place, and she'd get them to leave. If anyone was lingering, she would get them out and tell them about healthy work-life balance, and she'd act like a mother to them, say they needed to get off home and get a healthy life. And she'd portray herself as a great martyr because she was staying to do overtime. They all just thought that she was the most magnificent worker, and she was staying to do work in the evening while valiantly telling them to go home. Actually, as soon as the last one was out the door, she was making greetings cards, and that's what she was doing. It went on for a long time. And so the next thing that happened was this. One particular time, a chap, we'll call him Neville. Neville was what's called an outdoor clerk. He used to go out and visit clients at their homes or travel around getting evidence and so forth. And he came in to the office late one evening at about 6:30 p.m. because he'd been on the road reporting back to the office to put some papers in. And he saw Julie there making cards in the office. And of course, this wasn't according to plan. And this is how remarkably clever and quick-thinking the wicked are in lying their way out of a tight corner. Now, Julie wasn't very bright. She was a bit of a dunce, really. She'd left school at 15. She'd got past no exams. She was reasonably okay, but she was nothing academic at all. But she was as cunning as a fox when it came to being wicked. This is the point. So in comes Neville, and she couldn't afford to take the risk that he might talk to me. He might mention to me that he saw her making cards in the evening at 6:30. Probably he wouldn't, because like most chaps don't mention anything. They don't mention if they saw a bomb go off in the office. They wouldn't mention it. But the thing is, she couldn't take the risk. She couldn't take the risk. So she had to do something. So what did she do? The very next morning, she took this cleverly calculated risk. She came to see me the very next morning and asked if it would be okay if she could stay late tonight to make cards in the office because she's got some kind of a problem and they can't do it at home, and would it be okay if I did it in the office? I just said, yeah, okay, no problem. So I authorized it for that night, except, of course, it was the night before. And what she gambled on was that if Neville spoke to me, it probably wouldn't be for a week or so, because he's always out on the road, and I probably wouldn't see him. And so, she was right. I didn't see Neville for quite a long time. And it worked out. The point worked out. So when Neville did mention it, it seemed to me, as it was meant to seem, that he was obviously referring to that night that I had authorised her to come in and work that night. Except that night was the following night, not the night before. Hercule Poirot would have got this much quicker. But I wasn't Hercule. But the thing is, it was the following night that she had done this for. So you see how cunning that was. But it's even more cunning than that, because the point is that that morning when she came in to ask if it would be okay for her to work that night, she actually waited for a while. I remember it. God has a way sometimes of making me remember things that are seemingly insignificant. And I remember her pausing for a while, chatting, just chatting, and she was waiting to see whether I would say, "Oh, funny thing happened last night. Neil rang me and said he saw you at the office," or, "Neil's just been in, he says he saw you at the office last night making cards." And Neville, I mean. And the thing is, she thought I'd say that. And that's a possibility. Now, if I'd said Neville's been in, and Neville has said he saw you making cards, it was like a flowchart. If I said Neville's spoken to me, she'd go this way and say, "Oh yes, something came up, I'm terribly sorry, I stayed behind." And then of course she wouldn't have claimed any overtime. But if I'd said nothing, and a good while went by, 10 minutes while she was doing stuff and dusting and all that kind of business, and I didn't say anything, so she thought, probably Neville hasn't said anything. So that's when she said, "Would it be okay if I stayed tonight to work in the office?" And it worked. It worked brilliantly. And she got away with it. So there you have a situation where she's caught red-handed, I'm told about it, and I still don't get it. Now do you see why I say my IQ used to be low? But the point is, you learn from these things, and I make it my policy to point out all my mistakes to people, because I find it encourages people. Because they think, well, if you can make mistakes, then it's not so shameful for me to make mistakes. If you make them, then I don't have to be so embarrassed about admitting that I make them. And admitting that you make mistakes is really, really important if you're going to start being discerning and wise. You've got to admit that your IQ is low at the moment in order to raise it. So, where are we? So how did she get all this? How did she get all this kind of shrewdness? It wasn't from being naturally clever. I think if I had caught some professor of English literature or something like that, he probably wouldn't have been able to think of that. Do you see? Or a mathematician or someone. They probably wouldn't be able to think of something like that. But she could. Why? Partly feral shrewdness, that feral cunning I speak of that the wicked have. But partly demonic guidance. Demons are absolutely real. And most of the church doesn't believe they even exist. And even those who believe they exist, they only exist in theory. They live somewhere else and they affect someone else, somewhere else, at some other time. But they don't affect us now here. Well, actually, demons are real and they affect us now here. And they affect people you know and they affect you. They lie to you, they trick you, they undermine you, they harm you. And they get that craftiness in part from demons. So another thing that Julie used to do was to get rid of any staff that would be a threat to herself. And this is something that people have consistently done, and it's one of the reasons why I struggled with recruitment, because I always seem to have others involved who are sabotaging my recruitment. Before her, there had been a woman, I've given her the name Chloe, I think I gave her the name. She used to sabotage the recruitment. Then Julie did. And it's something people have done to keep out the good staff and bring in the bad ones. So if she knew someone good was applying, she'd do something to stop them getting the job. So did Chloe, the other one, before that. So she sabotaged people's applications, or during their probationary period, she'd try and nobble them. If she saw that they had talent, they were honest, or they had discernment, or if they saw through her, And later in the book, I'll tell a story about a woman who did see through her. A woman called Caroline saw through Julie. Julie nobbled her. So the thing is, that's the sort of thing they'll do. And so I had set up this system of probationary periods so that we could protect the firm from bad staff. Julie was using the probationary period to protect herself from good staff. Do you see? So she was nobbling them, sabotaging all of the good people as far as she possibly could. And she didn't mind if bad people came in. They were no threat. The threat was godly, good, honest people. And there would have been quite a few of those, because I used to really try hard to get them. And I think a lot of them perished, you know, in the first early stages. Never got past the frog spawn stage. You know, they always should nobble them. All right, change of topic. On the subject of witchcraft. Those who practice witchcraft have the ability to plant thoughts into your mind. And Julie had this in a big way. It's an uncanny ability to try and influence your thinking. They actually literally plant thoughts in your mind. Sometimes they do it by a kind of subliminal suggestion, very subtly just suggesting things in the most tangential way, such that the idea sort of lodges at the periphery of your mind, and later you find yourself forming the thought. That's one way they do it. But also they do it in the sense of actually gaining a kind of control over your mind, a little bit like a hypnotist does. The wicked who practice witchcraft in this way have a way of gaining a control over your mind, partly through demonic influence, but partly just through soulish control of other people's minds. And it's, even when I mentioned hypnotists, you've seen those kind of stage hypnotists, they're absolutely real. They really do get control of people's minds. Now that whole thing, hypnosis and so on, is another aspect of witchcraft, which is one reason why we should never engage in hypnosis or go to a hypnotist, even if we do want to give up smoking or something. It's better to smoke than to go to a hypnotist. Better still, don't smoke. But if you must, then don't go to a hypnotist about it. And the thing is that it's one of the main hallmarks of witchcraft is the ability to control other people's minds by various means, planting thoughts, influencing the way you think, influencing the way that you conclude things and make decisions. Another thing Julie did in her campaign of deception, she used to give the impression she was doing a phenomenal amount of work. And the way she went about it is very simple but ingenious. We had a lot of staff. And as I said, at the peak we had just over 80 staff. And she would go around getting staff to give work to her and for her to pass to me. So she would be the conduit. She would go to them and get them to do a piece of work that I had asked for, allegedly. Actually, I'd asked her to do it. So she'd go to them and get them to do it. So if I'd asked her to do something, she would go and get them to do it, but she'd say, bring it to her. Then they would bring it to her, and she'd swap the initials on the letter or on the document. You know the letters where you put S-A-K, that's my initials, plus they're her initials, and then the client's initials, and so forth. Well, she would then swap that to look as if she had drafted the document, done the research, drafted the letter, drafted the memo, whatever it was. So you'd get secretaries and trainee solicitors and clerks and other people to do tasks, and she would then take the ownership of that task and then present it to me as her work. So she gave the impression always to me that she was phenomenally industrious. You know, she was just like Boxer the cart horse from Animal Farm. She was always just working, working, working. And I was so impressed with her. But the point was, she was like the Wizard of Oz. The whole thing was a complete illusion. And she was getting all these people to give her work, but she wouldn't overdo it. She'd only get each one to give them, you know, 5% of it from him and 5% from her and 5% from her. Any one of them wouldn't have considered it very significant. And also, they didn't check up. So they didn't know that the document had gone to me with her initials on. They just thought I'd had it with their initials on. They wouldn't put two and two together. They wouldn't join the dots up. Now, bearing in mind that she was staying on an average and doing 2 hours overtime a night, and sometimes coming in doing overtime on a Saturday, it made sense to me that she was phenomenally industrious, because she was working all day, supposedly, and all evenings and weekends, work, work, work. But in fact, she was making cards, and these other people were doing the work. But my IQ, being in those days only in single figures, I didn't see through it, and neither did anybody else. Nobody saw through it. It went on an ever larger scale. And again, I tell that story because I want people to see that you can get tricked by people. You can get deceived. And I'm not as daft as some of you look. The thing is, but I got deceived. I got deceived by her. And we should openly say so, because most people, when they're deceived, they keep quiet about it. Don't even tell themselves. They won't even admit it to themselves. You should admit it, because it's important for the sake of other people as well as yourself. The only people who are pretty much immune to getting tricked are the wicked. So if you never get tricked, you're either Daniel or you're wicked. Because the thing is, ordinary, godly people get tricked. Your task is to minimize it and reduce its frequency and its extent and its severity. The idea that you never get tricked, you're kidding yourself if you think that. You do. And the only people who are broadly immune to it are the wicked, because they can just see it a mile off. The wicked person can see the techniques being used. It's like a card sharp watching another card sharp. You know, you've no use trying to out card sharp a card sharp. They can spot each other's methods. But a card sharp working against some ordinary person, it works. Let me tell you another story. This one, I'm going to give her the name Kira. Now, she was a supervisor, a solicitor, that means a lawyer, and she was a supervisor as well. And I took her on when I was urgently in need of staff. We were growing very rapidly at this point. Our advertising and so forth was working really well, and the firm was growing like a mushroom. And I needed a staff urgently. And she was so convincing at interview. I was so impressed by her at interview. I took her on, and to my foolishness was so high, I didn't even take up references for her. I just took her on. She was available, and I took her straight on. Also, she seemed so impressive, and she was very extrovert and engaging, and I really had the gift of the gab. Now, the point is, what I've learned since is, the more extrovert, engaging a person is, the more they have the gift of the gab, the more you need to check the references. The more impressive they are, the more you need to check, not the less. The more you need to look into things. And actually, if I had checked her references carefully, I'd have discovered that she had a past whereby she had left one or two law firms before that under a cloud with her files in a mess. And I learned that later from someone, but I didn't know it at the time. So when Kira joined us, she began a series of different schemes and deceptions, and I'll just give the details of some of them. So the first thing she did was to get me to recruit three junior members of staff, what we call file handlers or fee earners. They weren't solicitors, but they were what we'd call paralegals or legal clerks. And she got me to recruit three of these that she had known in previous firms. And she told me they were excellent. So I took her word for it, because she was a supervisor and she saw they were available, and I took them on. And when I took them on, it turned out that all three were just incompetent and had terrible attitudes and were really, really poor quality. I was puzzled. Why did she think they were so good? What made her think they were excellent? At first, I just thought she perhaps lacked judgment and had no judgment on how to assess the quality of staff. Of course, it had nothing to do with that. She wanted them in because they were friends of hers, and she wanted to increase her control over the firm and over the staff. And she needed people who owed their jobs to her and whom she had brought in and who owed her something. And through those people who could be her eyes and her ears, she could gain more control. Now, all that is alien to a godly person. All this sounds so alien and so, just so strange. You can't imagine it. But that's not alien to them. That's the way they think. They want control. That word control is going to come up a lot in this series of talks. They want control over things that is not legitimately theirs. And they want to get it by nefarious indirect means, such as this. Getting people brought on, pretending they're good people, so that they can use them to have more control. Now, where she misjudged me She thought I would just keep them. Now, you remember I spoke about how you need to confront things. These three people, none of them were any good, but not only were they no good at their jobs, they weren't very good people either. And I got rid of all three of them. Now, she'd assumed I would never do that. But one of the things I would do and did do is I was determined I would not have incompetent, lazy, careless people working for me. And leave aside the malice and deceitfulness and side of things. Certainly won't have that. I wouldn't tolerate just systematic incompetence and laziness either. So I got rid of them. Now, she'd have been right to assume that of most bosses in the UK. Most bosses in the UK would have let those three stay. Those three would have stayed in their jobs. So that's where she misjudged me. And she misjudged the situation. So that was a bit of a surprise for her. But from that moment on, she changed her way. And this is another thing with the wicked. If you block their way in some particular way, they'll find another way. They're resourceful. And this is what she then began to do. So she began then to get people to apply to the firm, either unsolicited or responding to adverts. But she told them not to say that they knew her or that she knew them. So she got a number of people to apply to the business. And I was interviewing people, not knowing that they were her friends, not knowing that they had any connection. So because the first three had been chucked out, she was trying to get more in, but this time by a different means, by subterfuge, by pretending not to know them. And they were to pretend not to know her. So in that way, I brought in this woman. I gave the name Mavis. She was a right nightmare. And I learned later that they knew each other, because I met another person. God used to arrange things for me to switch light bulbs on. So God arranged for me to meet a man on a law course. And when I went on this law course, this man knew both Kira and Mavis. And he knew that Kira and Mavis knew each other. And here I was, learning that two people who worked for me knew each other and always had. And I discovered it from another man who's a blind stranger on a law course miles and miles away. That wasn't a coincidence. God arranged it for me to learn that fact. He wanted me to know it. But the way that I rumbled her properly is that a young man came for an interview with me one day. He was a solicitor. Came for a job with us, and he turned up in reception for an interview. But Kira had forgotten to tell him to say that he didn't know her. And so, where she went wrong, she had planned to meet him in reception before I got there. But the problem was, I went into reception first. So I was the early bird, and I got there first. And I was in reception saying hello to him about 5 minutes before I was supposed to. I just turned up and picked him up. And anyway, in came Kira, running into reception, huffing and puffing, to get to meet this fellow in reception. And then she saw I was there. She looked horrified. And then she ran up to this man, and she said in a strange sort of desperate tone of voice, she said, she was panting as well because she'd run to get there. She said, "Good morning, Mr. So-and-so. I understand you work in Birmingham, although we've never met." And that's what she said to him. And it sounded like a funny thing to say to someone. Strange opening line. And as she said this strange-sounding remark, with a strange tone, she had a look on her face of panic. And this fellow looked at her, and you could see obvious confusion and bewilderment in his face. Because he knew her very well. That was why he'd applied, because he knew her. He knew the job, and she'd recommended him. But she'd forgotten to say, "When you come, don't say that you know me." Anyway, he didn't seem to know what to say, so he just stood there with his mouth gaping open like Bertie Wooster, being a confrontation with Sir Roderick Spode or something. And so his mouth was just gaping. So he had this surreal situation developing in reception, and I was looking upon this and thinking, what is going on? This is weird. But the penny still didn't drop. I still didn't get it at that moment. But my mind began to think, what's going on here? So later, I cleared her out of the way, and I had him in, and I asked him straight, "Do you know her?" Anyway, his mouth gaped even more like Bertie, and he said, yes, and he did. And the panic-stricken look on his face, though, gave it away. just a panic on his face when I asked him if he knew Kira. Why would that cause anyone to panic? Do you see the point? So what she'd been trying to do was to get her people in. Like, it's like, you know, CTU with Jack Bauer. They've always got somebody in CTU that's working for somebody, like the Russians or something. And I think they must have the same problem as me. So Kira must have something to do with the casting for 24. And there's always, she's bringing people in to do her stuff for her, do her work and support her. And this is the sort of thing that they do. Now remember, we're talking about the wicked being ordinary folk. They're just ordinary. This is going on all the time. Monkey business, you might call it, is going on all the time around you, in workplaces and churches and wherever you go. And you've got to realize that monkey business is going on and be looking out for it. And what did she want? She wanted control, a power base, and she wanted to build her power base and control people. But another thing she used to do, which is very damaging, she used to get junior staff to believe that I was like a monster, it was terribly to be feared, and that she could protect them from me. So she would protect the staff from me because of my sort of, me being such a psychopath. And that she would then be, you know, an emollient and patient figure who would look after them and protect them from me, as if I was some kind of Mr. Hyde or something. And of course they believe it, because they've got a supervisor saying that. Why would they disbelieve it? So she's offering them this protection service from this crazed, maniacal boss who goes around, you know, attacking people in the street. And that's something then they see as an advantage and a benefit. So she would get them to believe that I was a monster, she could protect them, she'd cover up for their mistakes and wrongdoings. In that way, she was harming the firm by covering up what they were doing wrong. She was also harming our clients by covering up problems, but she was also harming them. Because the point is, staff learn by making mistakes and having their mistakes pointed out and explained how you should draft a witness statement, why you don't want to be making that allegation, why you should be making these further allegations, why you should make your offer in this way, the right and the wrong way to negotiate, and so on. There's 101 things to learn about being a lawyer. And they could have learned so much more if they could have not been, you know, hiding from me. But they were hiding from me and getting their advice from her. And she wasn't a patch on me in terms of being a good lawyer. Although my IQ was low in terms of identifying the wicked, my IQ was high in the law of England and Wales. And hers was low on that. But it was high on wickedness. Do you see the point? And so they were being harmed just in order to make themselves useful to her, to pursue her benefit, to benefit her and pursue her objectives, not theirs. Okay. So years ago, tricks like that were beyond my ability to detect or understand. I didn't see them, I didn't anticipate them. Every lesson that's in Book 6 has had to be learned at great cost in terms of either pain or financial loss or endurance of various problems. But I've learned a whole series of lessons by seeing things go wrong. So now I'm different. I'm on the lookout for it. I expect problems, and I'm on the lookout for problems, and I'm actively looking for them. And what you aren't expecting, you won't see. And what you aren't actively looking for, you won't find. You know, it's like going through a wood. If you go walking in a wood somewhere with David Bellamy, actively looking for some particular kind of thing or a mushroom or a certain kind of lichen or a certain kind of plant or something, you're going to find it, aren't you? But if you go wandering through a wood just listening to your iPod, not looking for anything, that lichen will go undetected. That plant will not be seen. It might be there right by the path, but you won't see it. Because you're not looking for it. It's exactly the same with the wicked and the things they do. So, a liar, a deceiver, will even cause good people to behave badly when they believe the lies that they're told about and act upon them. So, the damage caused by lies goes much further than just the person who's lied to. Because the person who is lied to will then go on to do things in reliance upon what they, and they only, think is reality. So they are, the person who's deceived is in a kind of parallel universe. So they're in another universe in which fact, alleged fact A is a fact, but to everybody else, fact A doesn't exist. You see? So the universe they live in has this particular piece of information that they and they only believe. But everybody else lives in a universe where that is not believed. And that person will then go on, quite rationally, to act in response to and in reliance upon that belief that such and such is the case. Such and such a threat is the case. Such and such a problem. Such and such a danger. Such and such a thing has been said about them. Such a thing has been done to them. So and so has done this to them. They believe it and they act in response to it and in reliance upon it. And their actions then can be completely rational, absolutely rational, logical, in response to that, except there's only one problem. It's not true. That isn't the case. That isn't happening. That never happened. And that person can then go on to kind of commit career suicide. So the deceived person goes on to defend themselves against something that isn't there. And their defense of themselves can become increasingly eccentric, looking to others. It can look very unreasonable to others because they have no idea. The others have no idea that the person believes this thing. So other people around them will think they're behaving badly. I've seen that done where people have gone on to wreck their own careers because they've believed something that someone else has told them, and then that person lights the blue touch paper, walks away, and watches a rival commit career suicide so that they can pick up the prizes. And that's a surprisingly common thing. And most of the time, it's never discovered. Never, ever, ever find out about it. But you need to know that such a thing can happen in order that you can ask yourself whether it has happened. But the more odd someone's behavior is, the more irrational, the more strange sounding to you someone's behavior is, ask yourself that question. Are they believing something? Are they living in a parallel universe where they hold a belief known only to them, not known to me or the rest of us, which makes perfect sense to them of their behavior, which to the rest of us looks like very odd behavior? Do you see? And as before, we saw with the Tracy story, they won't come and check with you. They won't come and say, look, am I living in a parallel universe where I and I alone believe a fact which to me is real but to everyone else is not real? May I check it with you? May I check all the assumptions and beliefs that I'm currently holding? Nobody ever says that. They ought to, but they never do. So they don't check. And one reason they don't is because they've been told it's confidential, or I mean, as a friend, I'm telling you as a friend, just to help you. I'm putting my neck on the line. Don't go and ask because it's going to look bad on me. I'm only doing it to help you. And all that kind of thing. So they don't check. They make no inquiries. They make no checks. So if there's one thing you could learn from all this, is do not believe things that you are told without checking them. Check, double check, triple check things. Check the things that you're told, even down to small things. Don't just trust what people tell you. So, a person who's been deceived will go on to act to their own detriment and even commits career suicide as a result of what they believe. And the other person comes along and picks up the prizes and the benefit from it. And it also looks to everybody else that they're starting it. So that person A has been lied to by person B, and you're a bystander, you're person C, and you're discussing it with D, E, F, and G. And to you, the behavior of person A just looks really odd. And it looks like person A is starting a lot of problems. And C, D, E, and F, and G, looking upon this, think, isn't person A a right problem, a right handful? Person B is keeping quiet. Person B, and only person B, knows that there are two parallel universes. The one that C, D, E, F, and G live in, and the one that A lives in, is a different one. And B isn't telling, because B is the one that planted the lie in A's mind. But for everybody else, it looks like A is starting things. So sometimes the people that you think are a problem are innocent. They've been deceived by person B. And A, you think A is the problem, because A is behaving so aggressively, so in such a hostile way. He's being so difficult. He's being such a problem. But actually, person A believes a lie told to him by person B. B is the problem, not A. And what you must at least do is be alert to the possibility that that is the case. And this sort of thing is happening, I won't say continuously, but continually, in all sorts of places. All over the place. It's nothing. It sounds far-fetched, but I assure you it's very real. And lots of things that go on where papers are lost and very difficult circumstances develop, dates are missed, diaries are misplaced, all sorts of things happen in offices. And people think it's just random or just unfortunate, but it wasn't. It was deliberate sabotage by a colleague to cause harm to that rival. This rival and you are going for a promotion, and for a few months you interfere with and sabotage his papers and files and desk, diary, take things out of his diary, etc., to make him look incompetent. You have to be alert to that possibility. Be on your guard for it. Okay. Right. Now, one reason then, why lies do so much harm? One reason they do so much harm is because they're so appealing. People like lies, they enjoy hearing them. They're eager to believe them and pass them on. Lies are much more attractive than the truth, much more. I've seen this consistently, and the Bible supports it. It says here in Proverbs 18:8, it says, "The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down into the inner parts of the body." That's Solomon speaking. And he's talking about a gossip telling you secrets and lies and things, and accusations and rumours and things. Those things are really, really tasty, and they have such a beautiful aroma, and they're so delicious. People want them. But if you go to people and tell them the straightforward truth, that sounds like a cheese and tomato sandwich. You know, it's just sort of really a bit dull. You think, no, the lie is so much more exciting and appetizing. It's really much more flavorsome. And people like lies. They like them if they know they are lies. They like them if they don't know the lies. They just like lies. Lies are nice. Lies are tasty. And lies will be endlessly repeated and passed on. They propagate themselves. They go like wildfire. But the truth, as the famous saying goes, the lie is halfway around the world before the truth has even got its boots on. Because lies travel and propagate, and the truth doesn't. The truth isn't believed, and it doesn't travel, and it isn't repeated. The lie is believed, and it travels, and it's repeated. And that's the way it is. And you just need to know it. But also, part of the reason for that is that lies go with the grain of your flesh and your sin nature. The truth goes against the grain of your flesh and your sin nature. Remember, these three things, the world, the flesh, and the devil, are compatible computer programs, all of which work perfectly with each other. But they are not compatible with the new man, the spirit, the new nature. They're not compatible with that. And so, if someone tells you the truth, it's compatible with the spirit and the new man. The flesh, the world, and the devil don't like it. So not only does it go against the grain of your nature, but also the demons around you. And I say this, so many people who are Christians, they think demons have no influence over them. If demons didn't have any influence over you, or the devil didn't, why are we told to resist them? Why would you need to resist something that has no capacity to have any bearing upon your life in any way? The demons affect you in the sense they whisper into your mind, they even speak to you to discourage you, to demoralize you, to deceive you, to knock you down, to get you feeling really depressed, to get you all sorts of things. They'll do everything they can to you, even as a believer. But think, what do they do to the rest of the world? Think, what do they do to the unbeliever? Think what they do to the wicked. So the demon is doing everything it can to ensure that lies are believed and truth is not believed. So it's like there's a double effect. It accentuates the problem in both directions to cause the lie to be accepted and the truth to be rejected. That's what the demon wants. All right, let's move on. Now I'm beginning to look now at a section in the book on identifying the wicked, and I'm going to go on to talk about this next time in more detail as well. But let's just begin this subject. Right, when you are wanting to be discerning, you're wanting to find out about other people, the first thing you want to ask yourself, or one of the first things is, ask yourself, what is the other person that I'm dealing with? Are they primarily wise, simple, foolish, or wicked? Underline the word primarily. Remember what I said about grains of salt, sugar, sand, and pepper in a bowl? You're saying, what's the blend of grains for that person? Are they primarily wise, primarily simple, primarily foolish, or primarily wicked? And then act accordingly. Now, which part of that is not utterly obvious? That's utterly obvious that that's what you should be doing. But most people, when meeting anybody for the first time, or indeed for the 20th time, are not asking themselves that question, or any question, about this other person. Now, how can you begin, even begin to hope to begin to be discerning about the nature of other people if you aren't even seeking to discern, if you're not seeking to form a judgment? And the first thing you want to know is, well, what, broadly speaking, what broadly is the category they are in? Are they simple? Because if I'm looking at an audience and I think, well, if this audience is mostly simple, you know, or if this person I'm with is simple in the main, you'll approach them in a certain way. But if you think the person you're with is primarily wise, you'll approach them in another way. If you think the person you're with is primarily a fool, you'll approach him in another way. But if you think he's primarily wicked, you'll approach him in yet another way. In order to know which approach to take, isn't it totally obvious you need to first ask yourself, what, broadly speaking, is the group or category that he mostly belongs in? Subject to accepting that there are plenty of different variations therefrom, according to what time of day it is or what's happening and so on. So, if, therefore, you are addressing a person or dealing with a person, that's an essential first step. And if you start to ask yourself that question and spend time thinking about it, you may not get the right answers, but you'll be asking the right questions. And how can you possibly get the right answers if you're not even asking any questions? But if you're starting to ask the right questions, you'll begin gradually, over a period of time, to begin to at least edge towards having more discernment about things and about people. That's how I would put it, because it's not simple. None of this is simple. You aren't suddenly going to become the prophet Daniel if you buy book six. But what you will do is edge in that direction. That's what you need to try to do. So, but if you do then conclude that a person is primarily or regularly or at least frequently wicked, or is wicked overall, or there's quite a bit of wickedness in him, if you think that view, if you take that view, then don't waste any time trying to gain his approval, trying to educate him, train him, or improve him. Don't try to get his cooperation. Don't rely on him. Don't confide in him. Don't employ him. Don't promote him. If you think the person is wicked, don't do or try any of those things. Don't even try. That is your cue. When you think he's wicked, that's your cue not to try any of those things. Be on your guard with him. But also expect to receive from him hatred and malice and to be undermined by him. Positively expect. If a person is wicked and that's what you think they are, you need to positively expect that they are very probably going to be doing the things that a wicked person does. And one of the things that a wicked person does is to plot and scheme and undermine you. And that is what they do. So if you conclude that something is a dog, you'd think, well, I therefore, what do I deduce from this? If I've concluded that it's a dog, certain things flow from this. I think it will bark. I think it will run to the door when the postman comes. There are certain things I think it will do because it's a dog. And when you conclude that someone is wicked, you have to therefore anticipate certain things being done that the wicked do. And therefore you should be expecting those things. If a person is a fool, I would still say all those things. Don't try to educate him, train him, improve him, get his cooperation. Don't try to get his approval, he won't give it to you. Don't rely on him, don't confide in him, don't employ him, don't promote him. But a fool probably won't hate you or be malicious towards you like a wicked person is, unless you try to rebuke him. Now, if you try to rebuke a fool, then he will hate you. But a fool won't necessarily hate you until you try and rebuke him. But a wicked man will. A wicked man will hate you the minute you walk in a room, because the demon in him doesn't like what's in you. And he may not know why he hates you. Have you ever experienced that, where you just have the irrational, almost instantaneous hatred of a person towards you? All you did was walk in a room, and there's a hatred towards you, an antipathy that's immediate and visceral hatred towards you. I've had that, and I don't think it's my looks entirely that causes it. It's a demonic thing in them. The demon in them, the spirit in them, doesn't like the spirit in you. And that's true of the wicked. And don't waste any time trying to change them or help them in any way. The only thing you give the wicked is the gospel. Don't try and give them training and education and advice and so on. They won't take it from you. The gospel they need to be given, but not rebuke or correction. You're wasting your time. Just get them out of your business. Get them out of your church. Get them out. Don't try to cooperate with or train or retrain the wicked. All right, another point. We're looking now at ways of identifying the wicked. The things that we can be looking out for that will be a giveaway or a sign, a signal. And one thing I would say is this. Take careful note of how people speak about or treat others, not just how they relate to you. So, you know, people often say, well, I take people how I find them. It depends how they treat me. Do you see? If they're good to me, that's all right. Well, actually, you need to be more concerned about how they treat others and speak of others than you are about how they treat you and speak of you. And the reason is this. A person who's seeking to deceive you will treat you better than he will others. Especially if you're a boss or you're senior or you're a leader or you have something they want. They'll treat you better than they treat others. Therefore, you'll be seriously misled if you judge them at the level of or on the basis of the way they treat you or the way they speak to you. You will know more accurately the nature of that person by seeing how they speak about and speak to and treat others. That's a much more accurate test of what they are than of how they treat you, especially if you're in a position of authority or power or seniority or leadership or management. But even if you're not, the way people will speak to you will be better than how they speak about others. If they are speaking about others, you must know assuredly they will speak about you in the same way. If they're willing to badmouth and attack others, they will badmouth and attack you. And it would be folly of the greatest order to think that they won't. What logical reason have you to think that Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones, who's bad-mouthing Mrs. Brown, will not bad-mouth you? Or that's lying about Mrs. Brown will not lie about you? Or who hates Mrs. Brown will not hate you? Or who undermines Mrs. Brown will not undermine you? They will. And so you can gain an early sign of what they are about you behind your back, or what they'll do when you're not there, or what they'll say when you're not there, by looking at what they say and do about others when they're not there. It's very simple, but people don't do it. So they judge people by how they are to themselves, but that's not the most accurate guide at all. In fact, that's putting it mildly. It's the least accurate. So if there's any kind of mismatch between how they treat you and how they treat others, how they speak to you and how they speak about others, if there's a mismatch, that's a problem. There shouldn't be a mismatch. I always used to pride myself on this, that I would try and speak to everybody the same. And it doesn't matter whether they are the senior partner of another law firm or whether they are a secretary, or whether they are the janitor, or whether they are a client, a wealthy client, a non-wealthy client. It doesn't matter who they are. You must treat them all the same and speak to them all the same. If you're different with different people, that says there's something wrong with you. You shouldn't be different with different people. Of course, you should be different with the wicked from how you are with the wise. You should be different with the simple from how you are with a fool. But not because this one's a janitor and this one's a managing director. Not because this one's wealthy and this one's not wealthy. Do you see the point? You should differentiate between the wicked, the wise, the simple, and the fool. Yes, yes, yes. But you should not differentiate between the wealthy and the non-wealthy, the senior and the non-senior, the important and the non-important. And if you see people doing that and there's a mismatch in how they treat people, it's an important sign to you that there's something wrong with that person and you need to be more on your guard. And don't brush it aside. And don't assume it has an innocent explanation, because it probably doesn't have an innocent explanation. It's significant. If someone's doing that, they're putting on an act somewhere. If their real nature is being revealed when they are behaving maliciously towards person B. If they're being nice towards you, person A, the likelihood is that is not their real nature. What they're doing to person B is their real nature. What they're doing to you is a contrivance, is a fake, is a phony nature. It's not the real nature. So where you see two faces, the fact that there are two faces is your clue to think this person is false. You're not meant to have two faces. You're meant to have the one, whether you like it or not. You're meant to have the one face. You should show the same face always to everybody. You're always just you, being straight, being honest, being sincere, unpretentious. You're not manipulative, you're not trying to use people, you're just being really straightforward and sincere with everybody, and you respect everybody, and you're not trying to use anybody. And that's how you should be with everybody. But what you'll find is that other people are two-faced, and the mere fact that they are two-faced is your indicator that there's more. Because if you discover that a person is two-faced, you'd be very unwise to assume that that is the sum total of their wrongdoing. You would be wrong to fill in a report card on them and say, this person is two-faced and that is it. Their wickedness extends no further than that. There's nothing else that they do or are likely to do. It's just that. That's it. The chances of that are at or about zero. So if a person is two-faced, if he's phony, he will be wicked in other ways as well. He simply will be. It's simply inevitable that he will be. So, likewise, another couple of points. Always take careful note of how people behave and speak when they've had too much to drink. That's when their inhibitions are reduced and the real nature is more likely to be revealed. Now, what you'll hear people say is that so-and-so had had a few to drink and he wasn't himself. He was acting out of character. He wasn't being himself. It was out of character for him to do that. You'll hear this in magistrates' courts all the time. Well, your worship, sir, my client had been drinking and he was not being himself that evening. Well, that's not the case. When a person has been drinking, all that happens when you drink, it doesn't make you do things. It removes the restraints. So there are restraints in you brought about by all sorts of things. But alcohol is a restraint remover. It doesn't make you be anything or make you become anything. It stops you being what you already are. It stops restraining you. It removes the restraint that is currently preventing you manifesting your real nature. I remember a lad that I was at university with, and he was quiet all the time and sort of timid, really. But when he'd had a few drinks, he used to become really aggressive and want to have a fight. He'd say, come on, then, do you want something? Do you want to make something of it? He'd say, no, not really. Just coming in the kitchen. Sort of. But he'd want to start a fight. And he'd want to start a fight with anybody. Now, why was that? Was it drink making him want to start a fight? I don't think so. He wanted a fight anyway. But drink caused him to allow himself that luxury. Whereas ordinarily he would restrain himself. It removes the restraints. That's all it does. So drink doesn't mean that a person is acting contrary to their nature. Drink is revealing to you what that person's nature really is. And it just reveals, that's all. And what they do or say while drunk is what they really think. What they do or say while drunk is what they really are. At any rate, that's much more likely to be true than the converse, that they are simply acting out of character and you ought to place no reliance upon anything they said or did while drunk. That would be very foolish of you to do that. Very naive, I should say. Also, if a person says or does something that surprises you, that's not the norm for them, that goes against what they normally seem to do, don't assume that they're acting out of character. If a person does a thing that's bad or wicked or spiteful or nasty or cruel or whatever, if they do that and you haven't seen that before, you know, you've met them 10 times and they've never done a cruel thing before, don't assume that on this 11th occasion when they do the cruel thing or the spiteful thing or the nasty thing, they're acting out of character. Nothing that a person does in that sense is out of character. Everything you do is your character. That's what you are. And when you see the person doing that thing on the 11th occasion that you didn't spot the other 10 times, it wasn't that they weren't like that the previous 10 times. It's that you didn't spot it, or they didn't have an opportunity to do it on the previous 10 times. So when you see it on the 11th occasion, you don't want to write it off and say, well, that probably doesn't matter. I can't place reliance on one incident. I can't think that just because they stole that one thing or said that one nasty thing or did that one spiteful thing, that in any way tells me anything about them. That would be very, very naive. It does tell you something about them. It really does. And so it's much more likely that the impression that you had previously formed was a wrong one, rather than that this behaviour on the 11th occasion was an aberration or some kind of flash in the pan that means nothing. So basically, except where a person is believing a lie that is known only to them and not to anyone else, except when they're in that situation, as we spoke of earlier, where they go into parallel universe mode, unless the person is believing a lie and then acting in what they think is a rational way in response to that, anything that a person does is their nature. It is the real them. That is what they are. And as Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Well, it's the same. Out of the abundance of the heart, the body acts. What you do, the things you do, the things you say, the things you go about doing, they reveal what's in you. What's in you comes out in your words and it comes out in your actions. They are not inconsistent with your nature. They are your nature. And when you see people acting, you must place reliance upon the things you see. If you hope to be discerning, and if you go around denying yourself the right to do that, you are bound to be undiscerning because you are tying your hands behind your back, refusing to allow yourself to have regard to the facts by all sorts of constraints that you're putting upon yourself. And those constraints will seriously hinder your ability to be discerning. So don't brush them aside, explain them away, and assume they have no significance. Assume they have significance. Now, that doesn't mean you need to form a conclusion as to what the significance is. It means that you need to assume that there is a significance to this event, or this statement, or this action. Then your task is to say, what is the significance, and how great is it? Precisely what is it? Are they in a parallel universe where they believe something that's not true? Or are they wicked? Which is it? And what are they doing? Why are they doing it? It's meant to get you investigating. It's like when you see a thread sticking out of a cardigan. When you see that thread pulling out of a cardigan, pull on it, and all the wool will start to unravel. Well, it's like that. So when you see an incident like this, it's a piece of wool sticking out of someone's jumper or cardigan. Pull on it and see how much of the wool unravels. And what you'll find is things will unravel. More will come out. There won't just be that one thing. There will be others. But you weren't looking for them before. Now you are. You will find them. So you can't afford to go around seeing people with pieces of wool coming out of their cardigans and just standing there and looking and not pulling it. You've got to go and pull it. I hope you're not an audience that believes in literalism, because otherwise I'm going to get into trouble. But where you see wool from people's jumpers, You've got to pull. Well, I'll stop on that momentous note and we'll pick up on the next point to talk.